Ms. Hester.
May it please the court, Ann Hester representing D'Angelo Whiteside. No one disputes that D'Angelo Whiteside's 210-month career offender sentence is error. That sentence also amounts to both a due process violation and a miscarriage of justice that should be remedied on collateral review. The government's view to the contrary depends on an unsustainable stance that after Booker, district court sentencing discretion under the guidelines is unlimited. The Supreme Court's decision in Pugh and this court's decisions in the Carter line of cases demonstrate why the government is wrong. Appellate reasonableness review significantly confines the district court's sentencing discretion. Perhaps the most powerful limitation on sentencing discretion is the procedural requirement that the district court explain its reasoning and that a variance be supported by a more detailed explanation than a within the guidelines sentence.
Simply as a matter of circuit precedent, haven't we said that absent extraordinary circumstances, challenges to guidelines are not cognizable on collateral review?
The court has said that ordinary guidelines errors are not cognizable on collateral review. But this is not an ordinary guidelines error.
This is not what?
An ordinary guideline error. This court has...
So what I'm wondering is, what legal standard do we have to separate an ordinary guideline error from an extraordinary guideline error, given the fact that, under your view of it, all guidelines calculations would have some conceivable effect upon the sentence? I mean, what's the principle of limitation here? I'm not sure we can simply confine this to collateral attacks on career offender determinations. We have to have some basis in law other than our own feel about, well, this is significant and this isn't, for demarking. So what's the principle here?
Well, I think that the 11th Circuit case in Spencer and the 7th Circuit's case in Narvaez provide some helpful guidance about why career offenders are distinct from other guidelines errors. And one reason is because career offender is required by statute to be at or near the statutory maximum. And another reason is because, as Pugh explains and Spencer follows up on, career offender usually increases a defendant's sentence significantly. In fact, in Spencer, the court points out statistics that usually career offender designation doubles an individual's.
My follow-up question to you is, granted the career offender status increases the, might increase the sentence significantly, but that's true of any criminal history calculation. I mean, there are all kinds of federal sentencing determinations that depend upon prior convictions. And I'm not sure, given the fact that they all, along with base effect level, affect the guidelines range. Let's suppose somebody gets put in a criminal history 4 as opposed to a criminal history 2. That's going to have an effect. So is that open to challenge on collateral review?
I would suggest that it's not, because those types of bumps are really incremental bumps and not the significant change that career offender imposes. And in fact,
it can make a big difference, can it?
If you have enough of those errors, it can make a big difference. But I haven't seen any cases in preparing for this case where an enhancement other than something, a recidivist enhancement like career offender or ACCA, significantly increases a defendant's sentence. And I would refer the court to the decision in United States versus Maybach, where pre-Booker, the court recognized a post-conviction challenge to career offender status. I mean, I think that there is precedent for distinguishing these recidivist enhancements that significantly increase a defendant's sentence from other...
That decision was handed down in the era of mandatory guidelines, and the Seventh Circuit, in its Hawkins case, I think, indicated that there's a world of difference between mandatory guideline provisions subject only to very limited departures and advisory guidelines decisions which are subject to variance sentencing. I mean, the whole regime is guided by guidelines, but it's a good bit looser in terms of allowing greater district court sentencing discretion than it was at the time of the Maybach case that you cite. Plus, that was an actual innocence question. I'm not sure if that's what we have here.
We
have an actual innocence
question. I'm not suggesting that Maybach controls this situation, but I am suggesting that Maybach provides the court with some guidance about how you can distinguish career offender from other types of guidelines errors. I think that the Seventh Circuit Hawkins decision suffers from the same flaw that the government's reasoning here does, because it refuses to acknowledge the limitations on sentencing discretion created by the post-Booker appellate review for reasonableness really do make a difference in, really do limit the district court's discretion.
But you don't dispute the fact that the district court on resentencing could impose precisely the same sentence and says, you know, this is what I think this individual deserves.
Actually, I do dispute that, Your Honor, because of the requirement that the district court explain its sentence. And in a case like this, in Whiteside's case, the court's discretion to sentence below the career offender range, which was 262 to 327 months, first of all, was limited to reasons related to the substantial assistance, which is how he got below that range in the first place to 210 months. But also, appellate review for reasonableness would require the court to explain if it were to sentence down to the proper range of 140 to 175 months, the court would have to explain the reasons for doing that. So at the original sentencing, the court doesn't have reasons for going that low. And if it goes that low without explaining, then this court has demonstrated its willingness to vacate for substantive unreasonableness when the reasons don't support the sentence granted. But at the same time, if his sentence is vacated and sent back, there would not be reasons to support a sentence as high as 210 months.
The explanation is given a great deal of deference, and the district court could well say, well, I departed downward from the guidelines range the last time because of substantial assistance, and I settled on a particular figure. I could have departed much further down, but there was only a 20% downward departure in the initial sentencing, and it was open to the district court to depart further, but apparently the district court didn't believe the defendant deserved that extensive a downward departure. And this is not a situation where someone's convictions have been vacated. Drug convictions are still very much on the record. Nothing has changed about the underlying facts of those.
That's true, and for that reason, it would be very difficult on remand for the district court to justify a sentence that is 6.5 to 8.5 years longer than the correct guideline range based on the same reasons that it gave at the original sentencing. I think it would be, the district court would be hard-pressed to justify a 210-month sentence where the defendant provided substantial assistance and the correct guideline range begins at 140 to 175 months. Under Hicks, Whiteside has a liberty interest in being sentenced within the full scope of the district court's discretion. And the combined effect of the career offender enhancement and appellate reasonableness review prevented the court from exercising its discretion to impose the much lower sentence that Whiteside should have received. Denying Whiteside relief from this deprivation of sentencing discretion based on a conjecture that he might receive the same sentence on remand violates due process under Hicks. But even if Whiteside's sentence is not a due process violation, it is...
Did you raise the due process violation below?
Repeatedly, Your Honor. I know the government says in its brief that we didn't, but we...
The government says you didn't.
We repeatedly raised that below, both in our motion and in our response to the government's, our reply to the government's response.
This was before the district court?
Correct. Now, the district court never ruled on that because the district court's ruling related to the appeal waiver and the timeliness issue.
What exactly is the nature of the due process claim?
The nature of the due process claim is under Hicks, the district court was deprived of its discretion to sentence at the appropriate guideline range. It's that deprivation of sentencing discretion from the sentencer that is the due process violation.
I'm not sure I understand. How can that be limited?
How can that be limited?
I mean, if you could just slap a due process label on everything, couldn't you?
Well, not if the district court's sentencing discretion was not, not if the district court wasn't deprived of discretion to sentence. And I think the Eighth Circuit Sunbear decision provides an example of where that would be the case, because in that case, the defendant's career offender sentence was also within his non-career offender guideline range. So there would not be...
How is the district court deprived of its discretion?
Because it had to begin with an incorrect guideline range and procedural reasonableness requiring it to state reasons for its sentence in addition to the substantive reasonableness, whether the sentence fits the reasons given, prevented it from sentencing at the appropriate guideline range of 140 to 175 months.
And yet the guidelines remain advisory, and the Gall decision says that under an advisory regime, district courts retain discretion and that they're not permitted to presume at the trial level that the guidelines range is correct. They don't accord a presumption of correctness to it under Gall.
While that's true, at the same time, Pew recognizes that the procedural measures are intended to make the guidelines a lodestone of sentencing, and in fact, Pew cites empirical evidence demonstrating that that works, because when a guideline range moves up or down, offenders' sentences move with it. So at some point, the district court discretion is removed to, the district court is not free to impose whatever sentence it feels like imposing. It has to impose a sentence that is supported by reasons that are based on the evidence.
Maybe, but that seems to me to fly in the face of the thrust of the Gall decision, which was intended to weaken the grip of the guidelines on district judges, to retain for them a place, but to retain for them an advisory place. I wonder if I could shift a little bit. Under our Pettiford decision, we would look at something that was a non-constitutional error only if there was a manifest injustice. And manifest injustice, both in the fourth prong of Olano and elsewhere, has been thought to denote a judicial proceeding that was almost so riddled with error that it wasn't even worth the name. Now, I do understand that Simmons is the relevant precedent of this court, and that going forward, Simmons certainly controls. But the question here is, was it a manifest injustice at sentencing for the court to impose a sentence that was concededly correct under the law as it existed at that time? HARP has been overruled, but at the time it was remained the law. A panel of this court initially affirmed the HARP regime. There was a Supreme Court justice on that panel. And it since went in bank, but at the time, this petitioner which was before Simmons, at the time this petitioner was sentenced, it was in accordance with law. And one can disagree about Simmons, but surely a sentence that's imposed in accordance with the law as it exists in that time on an issue that is debatable. There were these convictions there. They were punishable by more than 1 year. And I'm just a little bit hard-pressed to say how that is a manifest injustice sufficient to open up collateral review. What do you say about that? How do we get to a manifest injustice?
Well, I think it's incorrect to say that the law, Harp and Jones, after Simmons, we now know that Harp and Jones were incorrect all along. So he never was punishable by more than a year for those prior convictions. And we know that his sentence...
The sentence was imposed before Simmons, wasn't it?
Correct. But we now know after Simmons that Harp and Jones were incorrect. So while they were binding precedent, they were incorrect binding precedent. So I suggest to the court that is a manifest injustice to sentence someone
so
to...
So anytime there's a change in law, it's a manifest injustice.
I wouldn't go so far to say that. I would just say that in this case, it's a manifest injustice where a person is sentenced to between 6 and 8 additional years in prison based on law that we now know is incorrect.
What further comments would you like to make?
I will...
You've got rebuttal time. But
I do have rebuttal time.
Some time and questions. I want to make sure that you have...
Well, I was going
to
address...
I was... You want to make.
Planning to address the timeliness of the motion under F4 and the equitable estoppel issue.
Why don't you briefly take those up?
Okay. Whiteside's motion was timely under F4 because he filed it within a year of the en banc Simmons decision. And under Johnson versus United States, Simmons, in conjunction with its effect on Whiteside's prior North Carolina judgments, generated a new fact for purposes of F4. The government has offered no compelling reason why the fact in Johnson, an order vacating a predicate conviction, should be treated differently from the fact here, which is a judicial opinion that fundamentally alters Whiteside's criminal history. First of all, contrary...
Going on to F4 here?
Yes. First of all, contrary to the government's position, Whiteside is not suggesting a limitations period that depends on any subjective knowledge. And second, the government has not identified a single case rejecting application of F4 to a judicial opinion that alters a defendant's criminal history as Simmons does. The cases it cites don't address that situation.
Where does that leave F3?
That's my next point. Contrary to the government's argument, adopting Whiteside's position doesn't render F3 meaningless any more than Johnson does. As demonstrated by the lack of cases addressing F4 in similar circumstances, Simmons presents an unusual, if not unique, situation. So Whiteside's interpretation of F4 is unlikely to apply to many, if any, cases other than those recognizing Simmons' claims. But even if Whiteside's motion was not timely, equitable tolling applies because Whiteside has been pursuing his rights diligently, and extraordinary circumstances in the form of entrenched circuit precedent stood in his way. The government's argument is basically asking this court to apply a rigid per se rule that a change in the law does not justify equitable tolling. But under Holland versus Florida, equitable tolling principles require flexibility. Mechanical rules are disfavored.
Because doesn't the statute set up a sort of a distinction and a dichotomy in F3 and F4 between matters of law, which fall into the channel of a Supreme Court decision that the Supreme Court has ruled to be retroactive, and matters of fact, which if F3 is not to be rendered superfluous, would be something different from a matter of law or a decisional change. It seems to me that Congress has covered the decisional change in F3. And said, okay, when there's a change in the law or a later decision comes along, this is the circumstance that we want to have the statute of limitations run from. But that has to be a Supreme Court decision, which the court has held to be retroactive. That's the only instance in which Congress has addressed decisional change, and it seemed to limit it to the Supreme Court decision.
Well, in Johnson versus United States, the Supreme Court addressed that dichotomy, and it pointed out that Congress did not necessarily consider every potential situation, and it hadn't considered the situation in Johnson. And I think at one point the Supreme Court described the AEDPA as kind of, as a sow's ear of drafting, that it wasn't drafted all that well.
But there the decision was vacated. The predicate conviction was vacated.
That's correct. But in this case, Simmons fundamentally changes the character of the underlying conviction, making it a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And if a recidivist offense is a different offense than a non-recidivist offense, basically that converts it to a different offense. So it's that situation is nothing like any of the cases that the government cites. And I suggest to the court that it's more like Johnson than it is like the cases that the government cites, which deal with things like jury instructions. So
we have a raging circuit conflict over this issue, huh?
Well, not yet. I wouldn't call it a raging circuit conflict. I would say that we have a paucity of decisions addressing a situation
so
like this
one.
We have
the Seventh and Eighth Circuit on one side of this, and then we have the Eleventh Circuit on the other. You can try to say that the Seventh and Eighth Circuit really weren't, but I've read those decisions pretty carefully.
Well, yes, if you're talking about cognizability instead of F4. I was talking about
F4
in that circumstance.
Talking about the earlier point. Anything else?
Just if the court permit me to make a point about the equitable tolling, Simmons' reversal of well-established precedent created an unusual and unpredictable circumstance that calls for special treatment. And I would just like to point out to the court the Powell decision. The Troy Powell's case really demonstrates how extraordinary these circumstances are preventing someone like Whiteside from filing earlier. Because under Powell, if Whiteside had filed his 2255 before Simmons, based on Carachuri-Rosendo, it would have been dismissed because Carachuri's not retroactive. But if the court adopts the government's position on timeliness, filing after Simmons, which is retroactive, makes his claim untimely. So that really puts him in a catch-22 position where there's never a time when he can file his claim that will be considered on its merits.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let me ask my co-panelists if they want to have any questions. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Ray, we're pleased to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Amy Ray for the United States. Your Honor, the district court in this case properly denied and dismissed Mr. Whiteside's Section 2255 motion to vacate for three reasons. The first is that Mr. Whiteside waived his right to even seek this relief in the district court, and the district court in this case properly recognized that he had knowingly and voluntarily waived his right to seek post-conviction relief. The second reason is that his motion is untimely, and the third reason is that his motion to vacate does not present a cognizable claim for relief under Section 2255. I would note that this court has not yet issued a certificate of appealability, nor has the district court. So we must first consider whether or not a certificate of appealability may appropriately issue in this case. And in order for
did we deal with the first of your questions when we denied the waiver point on the plea agreement, when we denied the motion to dismiss the appeal?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, because our argument in the motion to dismiss.
If we agreed with you, wouldn't we have dismissed the appeal?
Well,
waiver point.
I don't think so. Now, the court did not provide any reasoning it was just simply dismissed. Mm-hmm. I would note, however, that the government's argument in the motion to dismiss is distinct from its argument now. So in the motion to dismiss, it was about an appeal right. It was this appeal should be dismissed because the defendant waived his right to appeal. And the defendant argued that no, in his plea agreement, it says he may appeal the career offender designation. Now the issue is, did the district court properly hold that the waiver precluded him from seeking this relief in the district court? So it's a little bit of a distinct right. One is an appellate, one is a post-conviction right. We did argue in that context that the post-conviction right waiver precluded his appeal, but it is distinct, and this court could still hold, and I think should hold, because the plain terms of the plea agreement say
that he would... I'm sorry, Ms.
Ray. Yes. Is
the question on the COA one of whether the district court properly, or is it rather whether it's debatable whether the district court properly?
Judge Davis, you're absolutely, in terms of the COA, it's whether it was debatable, and I was hearing Judge Wilkinson's question as one going to the merits as well. In terms of the, but I, the government would argue that either way, no reasonable jurist would read this plea agreement and not conclude that this defendant had voluntarily and knowingly waived, and he doesn't challenge the knowing and voluntary part, and the plea agreement discusses these rights distinctly. It cites different provisions. One is post-conviction. It's a different procedure, different time, and one is appellate.
You have to make some sort of implication. I mean, when we take plea agreements, you're the one that often has a drafting role in this, and we hold the government to a strict standard, and you shouldn't force the court to get at your position by a little bit of implication, which it seemed to me we were. If you want to have a waiver, shouldn't you spell it out?
It is spelled out, Judge Wilkinson. It is spelled out quite clearly.
It's spelled out to the extent that there's a difference, that there are different paragraphs about direct appeal and collateral review, but it's not... Do you read me the language that indicates, in your view, that the waiver has been... of any collateral challenge to the sentence has been waived?
He says that he waives his right to challenge his sentence or his conviction under Section 2255 or similar authorities.
Are you reading verbatim?
Well, that, yeah, essentially. I mean, it's memory, but yes, it's on page, let's see here. Okay, it's on page 115 of the Joint Appendix. And it uses the language or similar authorities, but he specifically says, with the exception, the two exceptions, ineffective assistance of counsel and prosecutorial misconduct, neither of which is here, he waives his right to contest his sentence under, and it has in the previous paragraph referenced both post-conviction rights and appellate rights, and it says under Section 2255 or similar authorities. If this court holds that he hasn't waived his right, fair enough, but I do note that in Dawson, this court recognized that the government should get the benefit of the bargain. For sure, if this court determines that it's ambiguous, the ambiguity has to be resolved in the defendant's favor. But the government's position and my own reading of this plea agreement is that it's not ambiguous. It preserves a right to appeal the career offender designation, and that language is different from the post-conviction, which is included in plainly waived. Turning to the next issue of whether or not the the petitioner's motion to vacate is timely, even if this court holds that the petitioner did not knowingly and voluntarily waive his right to present his relief in the district court still properly dismissed his motion to vacate as untimely. With respect to 2255F4, the petitioner argues that Simmons had some effect on his North Carolina judgments. Absolutely not true. Those North Carolina judgments remain in effect and in full force, the same way that they did before Simmons.
I thought your argument was there that an intervening change in the law is not a, quote, fact.
It is, and that's exactly right, Your Honor. And so the Simmons did not, it is a legal decision that may have had some legal effect. That is to say that his prior convictions must be viewed in a different legal light. But it had absolutely no effect on those North Carolina judgments, as opposed to Johnson. In Johnson, the petitioner's prior convictions were wholly vacated, and that's the difference. It was the fact of the vacating of those prior convictions that triggered F4 in Johnson. This case falls within the heart of F3. It's a legal decision. Simmons was a decision of law that changed the legal nature, perhaps, but not the factual nature of those prior convictions. And therefore, it is untimely under F4, petitioner's motion to vacate. And there's no decision that petitioner cites in which there is a legal decision in the nature of Simmons that has been held to trigger a fact for purposes of F4.
Is a district judge's determination at sentencing as to the nature and character of a prior conviction i.e. whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, is that a determination of fact?
It's a determination of law as applied to the facts. But it's certainly a determination of law. I mean, whether or not something qualifies as a felony or, I mean, that is what Simmons was, right? It looked at the term punishable by more than 1 year in prison and held that that term, that language, had to be narrowed based, you know, as opposed to the decisions in Harp and Jones, that this court was interpreting that language as a matter of law too broadly.
But I'm moving past Simmons, and I'm a district judge sitting there at sentencing, and the government wants an enhanced sentence. Isn't it the government's burden to prove as a matter of fact that the defendant over here has a qualifying conviction?
Yes.
And you prove that matter of fact through a certified record and so on, but isn't it a matter of fact at the time of the sentencing?
Yes, it's a matter of fact in terms of the government must prove that the defendant has in fact been convicted of a prior a conviction
of
that
a
was
qualifying. Of a,
absolutely. Okay. However, whether or not something is qualifying is a question of law. And Simmons had the effect of changing whether or not prior convictions qualified as felonies. And that is a decision of law and not one of fact. So the government's position, and we believe it's a strong and correct position in this case, is that the Simmons decision falls right in with 2255F3, and if this court were to hold otherwise, it would undermine, if not completely render redundant, 2255F3. Turning to petitioner's argument that he is entitled to equitable tolling, the government's position is not that it is absolutely impossible or inconceivable that a decision of law could be a reason to trigger equitable tolling. The government's position in this case is that it's not appropriate for this defendant because there was no extraordinary circumstance that stopped Mr. Whiteside from making the argument that many other defendants had made before this court's decision in Simmons. That is to say, the en banc court's decision in Simmons. The en banc decision in Simmons was presaged by a number of other decisions. And along the way, I can tell you as someone who litigated these cases in the district court on the post-conviction matters, that we were seeing these arguments made regularly. So Mr. Whiteside could have made the same argument that Jason Simmons made, that Troy Powell made, and that many other defendants made.
So the government's submission is that after Harp, every lawyer appealing a sentence to this court after Harp, notwithstanding the Harp precedent, should have included in the brief, should have made it to district court and should have included in the brief to this court an objection to Harp asking this court to overrule Harp.
Your Honor,
are we to interpret the argument that everybody should have challenged Harp, and there's no excuse for not challenging a wrongly decided decision by a panel of this court?
With all due respect, it's not a question of what a lawyer should have done. That's not the standard. It's not an ineffective assistance of counsel question right now. What the issue is under Holland versus Florida, do we toll the statute of limitations because of a decision that this court rendered that followed many others? It's a question of equitable tolling, not what someone should have done, but whether there was an extraordinary circumstance that prevented him from doing it.
And the extraordinary circumstance, perhaps, is the ire of the judges of this court, surely to be visited on a continuous string of defense lawyers from North Carolina and elsewhere saying, please overrule Harp. I don't think appellate panels appreciate that kind of behavior. So I appreciate your argument. I do. And you're right to challenge equitable tolling. I'm just looking for the alternative.
Well, I think the alternative, I mean, in this case, you're not talking about challenging it from Harp on. But once Rodriguez came out, Pruitt came out, Carachuri-Rosendo came out, I mean, we had a string of decisions that put defendants on notice and their counsel that this was a viable issue. And Jason Simmons raised this issue in April of 2008, even before Rodriguez. So, and again, it's not really a question of whether someone should have done it. It's whether under Holland versus Florida there were extraordinary circumstances that prevented him from doing it.
I think Simmons and there 7-5.
Simmons, I should know that. I should surely know that. I do know, I believe it was 5, and it might have been 8-5.
No.
But maybe it was 7-5.
Judge,
in any event, it's...
Judge Floyd and Judge Thacker didn't participate.
Understood. And
in fact, it might have been 6-5.
It wasn't 6-5. But in any event, whether that was a close decision or not, by the time we got there, many other defendants had met this bar, which is to show and to prove that there were no extraordinary circumstances that prevented Mr. Whiteside from making this argument. Within a year of the final judgment of his conviction, which was rendered only, I guess his decision, his conviction became final right before, the year elapsed right before Simmons. So, but there were no extraordinary circumstances, and there's no case that petitioner can cite with a similar circumstance where there's a string of decisions, other petitioners are making these arguments and Mr. Whiteside isn't. So his claim is time barred, and the district court properly held it so. Accordingly, no certificate of appealability should issue, and the court shouldn't reach the merits of the question. Now, at some point, are the merits of this issue of career offender harm and Simmons, should it be reached by this court? Will it be? Perhaps. This simply isn't the case because there are procedural problems with it.
There's an awful lot of china that has to be knocked over to get to where the defendant wants to go. You've got the plea agreement problem, and then you've got the certificate of appealability question, and then you've got F3 and F4 and how they interrelate, and then you've got equitable tolling. And
yes.
Even if you get through all of those, knock over all that china, then you have the basic question,
right,
which Judge King had said our precedent foreclosed.
Correct.
And the question really is this an appropriate vehicle to just mow down all these obstacles and all these different questions to get to a position that is in conflict with two other circuits?
Yes, Your Honor. And
we're not playing from a position of strength here if we do that.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, and I think it's important to note that Congress set those barriers up. But I don't want to fail to at least address the merits of the issue.
No, I think you must, because
yep.
Your able counsel on the other side addressed them, and you need to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so turning to the merits, first of all, I would note that there is no reason why the district court in this case can't impose a 210-month sentence on remand. I would note that this petitioner has 7 prior convictions for assault with a deadly weapon on a government official, 2 drug trafficking convictions. It's quite possible that the district court on remand would or could.
Does the district court have that record before?
Absolutely, Your Honor, it did.
It would be hard to do so without a sort of a blatant appearance of, you know, it's sort of like paying. It used to be the old joke when I was practicing law, you know, if you plead guilty, you pay rent on the courtroom, you know, once you're sentenced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's rent for appealing.
Well,
winning on appeal in the Fourth Circuit. You think the court could just blatantly say, oh, I'm going to go up to 210?
Well, absolutely, because, Your Honor, the legal landscape has completely changed. I mean, on remand, the district court looks at it and says, okay, your guideline range is lower. Now I have a new question before me. I have to decide whether or not, based on your criminal history and all the facts of this offense, whether or not an upward variance is warranted.
It turns out that he had actually saved the life of a Bureau of Prison employee last year. Could the district court ignore that?
No, I mean, I think all of those questions would be before the court. But let me make clear, just in terms of legal standard, I wanted to assert, because I think it's important to assert, that this sentence was lawful then and it would be lawful now. And that is why it does not meet this court's requirement that it have been an error that rendered the entire proceeding irregular. That entire proceeding, while a mistake may have been made, was not rendered irregular or unlawful or invalid simply because of a mistake of the guidelines, no matter how large. There are other guideline errors that would constitute this dramatic a change. There are 12-level enhancements, 16-level enhancements. There are enhancements that could create the kind of disparate result that an error in the, as the career offender does.
Do you think he'd be able to... sometimes we have limited remands, and sometimes we have... I mean, it's all in the terms of the remand.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have broad remands. You suggest that this would almost necessarily, because if we ever get to that point, that it was even cognizable, it would have to be a broad remand. Mm-hmm. And the district court under, I said, you know, the code says no limitation shall be placed on the information a district court can consult during sentencing, and be no reason to place that limitation here to try to render a blind sentence when somebody, if somebody has 7 different convictions, at least under 4A1.3, any formal criminal history would probably significantly understate the record.
That's right, Your Honor. And that is, and the government would agree that if this case is remanded, it would be remanded for a new sentencing, a de novo resentencing proceeding. He would get the benefit.
The question is whether we even get to the point of holding that this is cognizable under our precedent. Judge King was very emphatic in saying in the Powell decision that no, this under our precedent, this just isn't cognizable.
That's right, and because there, unless absent extraordinary circumstances, and I don't think this court has ever seen such an extraordinary circumstance, guideline errors are not cognizable. A couple of points that I want to make in response to Ms. Hester's argument. First of all, with respect to Maybeck, this court in Pettifer quite plainly held and that Maybeck was limited to a situation, and first of all, that was a procedural bar question, not cognizability. But second, it was limited to a situation in which the prior convictions, the defendant didn't commit them, those offenses. And Pettifer limited Maybeck to that and recognized the limitation. Second, I note that the decisions, with the exception of the 11th Circuit's decision in Spencer, in which a petition for rehearing en banc by the government remains pending, the other decisions, Hawkins involved advisory guidelines, but Narvaez from the 7th Circuit involved a career offender error during the mandatory guideline system time when the guidelines were mandatory, as did Sunbear. And this case involved an error that was committed during the advisory guidelines, when the guidelines were advisory. And I think that's a critical distinction in the reasoning. Either way, this court's precedent holds that guidelines errors are not cognizable.
This is not a guideline error. This is not an error.
If I may answer your question, Judge Gregory, I see that my time is up. We have recognized, the government recognizes that now, in light of Simmons, we understand that the application of the career offender enhancement to Mr. Whiteside was erroneous. But certainly at the time it was made, everyone understood that it was a lawful sentence.
That's what I'm saying. That's a distinction. And it wasn't an error. Isn't that what makes it extraordinary and perhaps a manifest injustice? Because it was, we're not talking about an error in terms of calculations, that you got a point wrong, something like that. Part of that is because you had at least an opportunity to correct those mistakes when the district court made those during sentencing, normally, errors. Mm-hmm. But here, there's no error. The law changed. And isn't that sort of draconian? These sentences are already, in my view, rather draconian and across the board. And that's why Congress is trying to chip away at 706, 750, all these things, disparate treatment.
Mm-hmm.
For a person to remain in jail for prison for years longer than we now know the law to be, it's like someone convicted in certain states where marijuana was 20-year sentence, and then we came to a different states now make it even legal. Mm-hmm. They said, well, you remain because at the time, 20 years was the guidelines for that kind of, rather draconian, wasn't it? Wasn't that a manifest injustice?
You know, Your Honor, at least that Congress enacted the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and Congress struck the balance between finality and an error-free proceeding. And the way that that balance has been stricken is that if the law changes unless it is a law that changes and it satisfies F3 and it is, it creates a cognizable claim for relief, it simply isn't an error that is to be corrected. And Congress struck that balance. Now, this court can view the balance fair or unfair, but it is the balance that Congress struck. And this court's precedent has recognized that, and for good reason, because Congress made the determination that only limited claims could be corrected at this stage of the game. Guidelines errors don't fall within that, no matter how significant. And although I recognize that it was a court decision, and at the time it wouldn't be considered an error, it's not a manifest injustice where the law changes and we now understand that a defendant would not today be sentenced to the same sentence.
Why not?
It's just not one that, under these terms, it has to be a constitutional error, or it has to be one where the sentence was unlawful in some way, and it wasn't. It wasn't then, and it isn't now, because the district court could impose the very same sentence on remand. By definition, if a district court could impose the same sentence on remand and has the discretion to do so, it is not a manifest injustice under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, no matter how much anyone in this courtroom may wish it were so. It is not so, not under this court's precedent. And Judge King did recognize that, and the government respectfully requests that this court apply that precedent as it is. If the court has no further questions.
Hold on for just a second, Judge. We have no further questions. We thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Hester, we'd be happy to hear from you on rebuttal.
I'd like to begin where the government left off in talking about the finality interest and its relationship to manifest injustice, because I think it's important here when the court is considering the finality interest to understand how easy it is for the district court to determine whether there is a Simmons error in somebody's sentencing. Basically, the court has to look at one document, which is the North Carolina judgment, in order to determine whether there is a Simmons error or not. And it is very easy to process these cases. We know this because we have 120 of them pending in the Western District, and where the government agrees to relief, we have been able to move through those quite quickly. It is not something that requires any evidentiary hearing at all. So for that reason, the finality interest in these cases is diminished because it does not require a great deal of effort on the part of the district court to make a decision on post-conviction about a Simmons mistake.
I'm not sure finality is simply a function of how a court of appeals gauges it may or may not be, how difficult it may or may not be for district courts. Part of that may involve an evidentiary hearing, but another part of it involves the sheer volume of claims that are coming through. Seems to me every time I turn around, I'm seeing a new Simmons claim in one form or another. And a part of it is the volume of the claims that reach the district court. And in this case, there are going to be quite a few.
But that is about to end because it's a finite pool of people who will have these post-conviction Simmons claims, because from now on, they'll be caught at sentencing. So this is not something that will go on over time.
But I think, the finality interest is not simply the Simmons interest. The finality interest is in having the camel's nose in the tent and opening up guidelines provisions to collateral challenges, taking up a question of law and calling it a fact, and having guidelines calculations. I mean, every dramatic expansion in habeas corpus has begun with a step just like this. That's part of the finality question, is what do you set in motion?
I understand that. I just believe that part of that consideration should be the type of claim that this is. I would like to address the government's assertion that Mr. Whiteside has seven prior assaults, because while that is technically correct, all seven of those are related to a single incident where he was driving a car toward police officers who were directing traffic, and he was apparently under the influence of drugs or alcohol at the time, and that's an ongoing theme throughout his criminal history, is his alcohol and drug addiction.
Was that taken into account in the initial sentencing at all?
I don't know, to be perfectly honest with
the
court.
Were the assault convictions discussed in the initial sentencing?
Only from the perspective that they were consolidated with one of the drug convictions that was used as a career offender enhancement.
Ms. Hester, it seems like the argument of Ms. Ray, and ably argued, obviously, and eloquently done so, but it seems like the argument has shifted a little bit to not a question of whether we should do it, but they're saying this court, this panel, doesn't have the power to grant the relief that you're suggesting. You need to respond to that. They said we don't have the power. So just address that, because that's what the argument really is, that we don't have the power to do so. Can you address that?
I don't understand where that comes from, to be perfectly honest, that this court doesn't have the power to grant relief. I'm not sure if she said that in the context of...
Well, the whole context was that. Citing to Powell, and you heard Judge King's opinion, Powell, and somehow that somehow closed us, and COA questions, those type things. That's a hurdle you need to at least address, if it is a hurdle. If it's
first
not,
of all, with respect to the certificate of appealability, this court does need to issue a certificate of appealability. This issue actually came up in the Miller case, where the government acknowledged that the reasons for the certificate of appealability are not jurisdictional.
Right. It only takes one judge to do that.
Right, and all we have to make is a debatable showing of constitutional error, and we've done that.
All right.
And other issues can come along for the ride after that, once you have a constitutional error. So the other thing to consider is that the certificate of appealability requirement is an attempt by Congress to streamline the appellate process, and here we are at
oral. You can move on from that. I think I understand that. Okay. That gateway. What about the foreclosure argument on B3 and 4? That's nothing in there that prohibits. As Ms. Ray said, it prohibits what you're asking.
With the F3 and the F4?
Yeah.
Again, I'd point out to the court that the government, it says that, but there's no precedent saying that a situation, an unusual situation like this cannot.
What is the language that gives the flexibility that you say that we have some determination to do so? Because the argument is that we cannot by the very stricture of the language. What is the language?
The language is the fact language in F4, combined with the Supreme Court's interpretation of that in Johnson, where the court says that this, you know, basically the court said, this isn't pretty. Congress didn't think about this situation when it drafted these provisions.
That's not unusual.
Correct. But we have to find a way to figure out how to fit this different situation into this framework, and we're going to do it by saying that this court determination is actually a fact. And I submit to the court that this determination, the Simmons determination, has a similar effect to Johnson, because a recidivist offense is a different offense than a non-recidivist offense. I mean, basically, when you're talking about the fact of a prior conviction, which is what the court talks about in Johnson, you're talking about a determination of what offense the defendant actually committed. And
but the fact there was a vacature of the predicate conviction. Your position that a change in the legal status of a predicate conviction is a fact almost makes any intervening, it comes very close to making any intervening change in law a fact. And the question I have is, in F3, it seems to me that Congress did consider very concretely how it wanted to deal with decisional changes as they impacted on the statute of limitations. And it limited that in F3 to situations where the Supreme Court had rendered a particular decision after trial and direct appeal and what have you, and where it had ruled it retroactive. And it says only in that limited circumstance do we want to unwind the one-year statute of limitations. Now, as Ms. Ray points out, it's a trade-off between what you're advocating and the value of importance of finality that Ms. Ray is advocating, and the statute of limitations does express an interest in formality, and the particular exception addresses exactly what you're talking about, which is decisional changes. And it says it's limited not to a circuit court decision, which Simmons was, it's limited to Supreme Court decisions. And not just limited to Supreme Court decisions, but to Supreme Court decisions that the Supreme Court itself has decided to give retroactive effect to. And, you know, we start doing this or going the route of equitable tolling and everything, we're unwinding what Congress has done. The only question I have is an ultimate matter, is given what your ultimate position is, you've got to go through so much to get there in terms of circuit precedent, in terms of F3 and F4 and timeliness, in terms of the expression in the certificate of appealability section that constitutional claims would be the focus of a habeas attack. The question I have is, given the China you have to knock over, is this really an appropriate vehicle to make the kind of declaration and pronouncement that you would have the court make? Because that's, a lot of times questions are very interesting, but they're not procedurally set up in the right way. They don't have the right procedural glide plane. And that's the problem. That's one of the problems that I'm having here, but it's, I think, a serious one. I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, there's no denying that there are hurdles that we have to overcome in order to get to the cognizability issue. But as I've argued to the court, I believe that we get past those hurdles and get to the cognizability issue. And cognizability is relevant also to the equitable tolling issue. So that's part of the analysis the court needs to consider when trying to decide whether equitable tolling excuses him from not complying with the statute of limitations if the court concludes that that is the case. So, well, I can imagine better cases to set up the cognizability issue. These other issues are important as well.
Is there anything further you'd like to ask?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
I thought this case was exceptionally well argued on both sides, and I want to say that.
Thank you
both, and we'd like to come down and greet you and then move into our next case. Is that okay if we move in? Okay to move into the next case.